I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega, and you're listening to The Takeaway. Now, in the immediate aftermath of George Floyd's murder last May, activists organized protests against police brutality in the biggest cities and smallest towns across the U.S., everywhere from New York City and Washington, D.C., to Portland, Maine and Wilmington, North Carolina. We even saw protests reach communities with populations less than 1,000, like Millerton, New York, where at least one person stood with a Black Lives Matter sign. Now, several polls also estimate that between 15 and 26 million people in the U.S. participated in demonstrations last summer. In almost every pocket of the country, people marched and they chanted, they prayed, they knelt, they stood and sat and laid in silence for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. Even though we later learned Derek Chauvin knelt on Floyd's neck for even longer, 9 minutes and 29 seconds. In some cities, protesters blocked freeways, they filled entire streets, they demanded justice for George Floyd, for Breonna Taylor, for Ahmaud Arbery, and so many others, all in the thick of a deadly global pandemic. And these mass public actions demanding justice were not restricted to the United States. People in Thailand, Argentina, Mexico, Japan, and across the globe demonstrated in solidarity with Black Americans. In the UK, people came together in London not only to condemn Floyd's murder, but also to protest the police violence and systemic racism, all too familiar in their own lives.
Justice for Black people! Justice for all Black people!
Yeah.
Black lives matter!
Black lives matter!
Black lives matter!
And at the heart of these global protests was a reckoning with the imperial histories and the racist practices that continue to shape the lives of marginalized and oppressed populations. In Bristol, a city in southwest England, protesters even toppled a statue of a 17th century slave trader and dumped it into the harbor. In France and Australia, the murder of George Floyd resonated with Black and Aboriginal people who are all too often killed in police custody. In Indonesia, the uprisings following Floyd's death inspired the indigenous Papuan population to take to the streets and to social media with Papuan Lives Matter. And in Nigeria, months after the summer's protest, the spirit of Black Lives Matter was felt during the country's hashtag End SARS movement, which called for the dissolution of the Special Anti-Robbery Squad due to its widespread abuses, including torture and killings. The culture and the politics of Black Americans has long been agenda setting for social movements around the world. And the global impact of George Floyd's murder and the movement it ignited is no exception. Here to discuss that and more is Omar Wasau. He is an assistant professor of politics at Princeton University. Omar, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Omar, clearly neither racial justice nor state violence are new or even particularly rare. So why is it that this moment resonated across the globe?
I think there are three main reasons that the murder of George Floyd was so powerful. First and foremost is the video, particularly Darnella Frazier's footage that just in a way that was just kind of very visceral, very intimate, very powerful, allowed people to see the profound indifference to human suffering that Officer Chauvin indicated as we could watch the life drain from George Floyd's face, right? So that footage really was exceedingly important. And that's an echo of what we've seen in the past, where whether it was Emmett Till or Rodney King, that documentation of, in particular, state violence can be very powerful at mobilizing people. Another really important factor is that the Chauvin himself was just so extreme in his level of indifference, right? That it's not, there was, this wasn't a you know, an ambiguous situation. I mean, it was just very stark, so much so that we saw other police forces criticize that behavior, I mean, which we almost never see. And then lastly, I think the timing in the midst of the pandemic meant that where, you know, one of the core challenges for any social movement is trying to, you know, get a bunch of people to kind of show up at the same place at the same time. And people always have things going on in their lives. But during the pandemic, suddenly people were able to kind of focus on this particular injustice to a degree that would have been much harder without the pandemic.
I so appreciate that, because it reminds us that protests don't just pop up. They don't just emerge. They are actually organized by activists who bring people together in those spaces. But they're also, right, in addition to the work of activists and organizers, there's also those, what you have written about as seeds, those seeds of an agenda. So actually, just this week, you published an academic paper in the APSR titled Agenda Seeding and Thinking About 1960s Black Protest Movements. I'm wondering about the ways that Black American movements for freedom have seeded agendas abroad before. Is this something that we've seen happen?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think, you know, part of what is for me deeply fascinating about how social movements work is the way that they learn from each other. So, for example, just to go back to the 1940s, Bayard Rustin, a key influence on Martin Luther King's commitment to nonviolence, Rustin goes to India to learn from disciples of Gandhi about their non-cooperation movement. And we've seen similar echoes of the current Black Lives Matter movement on, as the introduction sort of really helpfully outlined, on movements around the world. And in particular, I think it's the emphasis on police violence, on unjust state violence, that has helped to focus, kind of, you know, when those incidents arise in a place like Colombia in recent weeks, that people have described it as their own George Floyd moment, right? And so in that way, there's a kind of a template and a sense of legitimate outrage at state violence that helps to mobilize people, building on what they've seen in Black Lives Matter in the U.S.
So I appreciate that you started with Rustin, because that shows us sort of the Black Atlantic, the currents moving the other way. But it does often feel as though it moves only sort of from U.S.-centric out. So I'm thinking of us learning just yesterday that Sasha Johnson, a Black Lives Matter activist in the U.K., is in critical condition after being shot. And we don't know from initial reports whether this shooting was directly related to her activism. But still, I wonder about, for example, the capacity of a Sasha Johnson to be a figure like George Floyd, also reigniting movements here in the U.S.
We definitely see this kind of cross-pollination happening in many different contexts. So, I mean, even, for example, you know, there was the Tahrir Square protests in Egypt, and that helped influence the Occupy Wall Street protests in the United States. So, and some of that is about tactics. You know, there's a particular method of protest, like occupying a space. But in other cases, like what you're describing, there are ways in which an iconic figure can become a kind of rallying point for a movement, and we also see, just to kind of speak to the international dimensions, there are ways in which sometimes there are activists moving from one place to another, kind of learning from each other. So the scholar Zeynep Tufekci, for example, has talked about how people in Turkey who organized a protest in Istanbul also helped share some of the methods they learned with folks in Tahrir Square. So there is, and particularly in the age of the internet, there are ways in which people are communicating, sharing tactics, trying to figure out how can they get their voice heard. And in the particular case you're saying, it's obviously still too early to say whether the UK might influence the US in this specific case, but it certainly happened historically.
So you dropped social media there. So I just want to think about the ways, though, that that has sometimes looked a little different relative to global actors. So, you know, we're being sort of celebratory of this idea of ideas and activism moving back and forth. But in the 2016 elections here in the U.S., foreign entities actually exploited Black Lives Matter language and images to work against, right, interests of racial justice. How can we sort of navigate that question of these illegitimate uses globally?
One of the core challenges for any social movement is to kind of capture the moral high ground and hold it. And there will always be a counter mobilization that tries to delegitimize the claims for equality or justice of that movement. And what I find in the 1960s is there are tactics. I mean, it requires often, kind of extreme kinds of methods, but making oneself the object of state violence, strategically doing that and getting media coverage of those kinds of attacks that, of course, can lead to trauma, injury, and death, but help to elevate an issue and do it in a way that is, sort of helps to just illuminate the injustice in a very profound way. That kind of tactic can work, but it's very hard to sustain.
Omar Wasso is an assistant professor of politics at Princeton University. He's also a little bit the whole reason that I know about the Black Planet and those questions of global organizing. Omar, thank you for your work for so long, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm really grateful.